Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Trisha's True Crime Radio. I'm delighted that you're with me tonight. I know there's a big football game, and a lot of you have the football sound down, and you have True Crime Radio on in your heads. That's the way it should be, by the way. Today's show is sponsored by a great group, Pause for Purple Hearts in Palo Alto, California. Pause for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind. They offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. I encourage you to go to www.pauseforpurplehearts.org. Okay, time for all of that goo that we call the legal stuff. Legal goo, opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, okay? So if you hear something you don't like, you don't take it to the forums, because WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org are completely separate entities. If there's something you hear that you don't like, you bring it to me, and we'll do our best to make you happy. A couple of things I need to correct. Last week I spoke about the Jahi McMath case. That's the young girl who was pronounced dead, and her family, based on, in my opinion, terrible advice, has had a feeding tube in her and has her heart and lung machines working on keeping the appearance of Jahi alive. Anyway, last week I mentioned she went in for routine surgery to have her tonsils out. Well, I forgot to mention that Jahi had other things wrong with her, like sleep apnea. She was very overweight, uncontrolled urination, and other things that could have contributed to her death, okay? And I'd like to thank my bouncer, my wonderful web sleuth, not the official co-host, but he's just named co-host in the chat room, who helps me keep out the troublemakers. And coming up, Michael in Minnesota, he is my official co-host. Also, Beth Karras from Wild About Trials. But first, our guest coming up grew up in a household, with an ultra-liberal mother and a, as he says, sober and rational father. It's a great combination. Who, even as a child, he was questioning punishment given out by others. He felt terrible about pulling the legs off a daddy long-legged spider. Now, after reading his book, The Death of Punishment, you will come away with the solid sense that Professor Robert Blecker is truly a man who seeks the truth no matter which side the truth is on. And he wants to see punishment handed out to those who truly deserve it. He was a special prosecutor in New York. He's a professor at the New York Law School. Let's welcome Dr. Robert Blecker, the author of The Death of Punishment. Dr. Blecker, welcome. And Professor Blecker, thank you for joining us. Oops, hold on. I think you're on mute. Just a minute. I do apologize. Hold on. I'm sorry. There you are. Professor Blecker, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Many would be pleased if I could stay muted, actually.
Not tonight. I'm sorry. It's not going to happen. And did you hear I upgraded your title? I made you a doctor by accident. So I do.
Yes.
I called
no,
you
I'm
Dr.
Not.
Blecker. I know. But
no,
that,
I'm just,
I just
someone
thought
who spent thousands of hours inside prisons.
And boy, are we gonna go over that tonight. That is for sure. Beth Karras, are you with us, my dear?
Yes, I am. Good evening.
Okay. Good evening. And my wonderful co-host, Michael in Minnesota. Michael, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you. I'm so excited for this interview. I can hardly stand it. Dr.
Becker,
now you've got me doing it. I was just reviewing your book because it's been so many weeks since I read it, and I just can't wait to really talk with you. So this is the perfect venue for this interview, and I'm excited to be part of it. Thank you.
I know. We are. And well, you said I could call you Robert, and that's wonderful, but I'll probably keep throwing in Professor Blecker, and I may keep upgrading you to doctor. I'm not sure. But, Robert...
It's not always an upgrade, because then you have to be a PhD, which might remove you from reality.
That is the truth. Robert, your book, The Death of Punishment, it is a compelling book that everybody should read. But before we get into the actual book itself, I want to talk to you about what happened just recently in Ohio, the botched execution of Dennis McGuire. Now, they say botched. They say he took 15 to 25 minutes, depending on which story you read, to die. And they say he was snorting. He was obviously in contortions. And apparently, if you read the newspapers, if you believe them, apparently McGuire had spoken to his family, because this drug had never been used before on an execution, and they were worried of this, they said, of this exact thing happening. Now, you have spent many, many hours. You are a PhD when it comes to punishment, whether you have the degree or not. You are the man that knows about punishment and prisons and what's really going on in that whole scenario. What do you think of this? Was it cruel and unusual?
Well, no, I don't think it was in this particular case, although it could be in some cases. They tried experimentally a combination of drugs. Of course, the irony is that the very people who are now crying the loudest that this proves that lethal injection and the death penalty itself is cruel and unusual are the very people who brought us to the point where they have to use experimental drugs if they want to keep lethal injection, because they've managed to pressure the European countries who supplied the drugs originally to withhold them under a threat of economic boycott and probably also a commitment to oppose the death penalty. So the net effect was and is that those states that and all the states who have the death penalty have it by means of lethal injection are forced to go, when their stock of it runs out, to start manufacturing the drugs in-house or the drug cocktails in-house. There's also an irony involved here, because we can't quite separate the reality from the appearance. The fact that he appeared to be in pain does not mean that he was in pain. In fact, the traditional three-drug cocktail lethal injection dose had the second drug be a paralytic agent so that the condemned would always appear to die peacefully. And some opposed that on the grounds that that might be masking real pain, and though it made it easier to watch and observe, it might make it more difficult for the condemned. This is all, in my view, a temporary dispute and a make-weight argument against the death penalty. It will pass, and I happen to join those who oppose lethal injection. I think it's a terrible method, but I oppose lethal injection not because it certainly causes pain, but because it probably causes confusion. And when I say that, what I mean is that I've witnessed an execution by lethal injection. It was the execution of Benny Demps. And it was eerily similar to another death scene that I unfortunately was at, and that was when my father-in-law died in a hospice. And he died in a hospital of mercy, in short, where they gave him a pain-killing dose, which was lethal, in order to prevent the pain when he was racked with pain from a deadly cancer. And the death scene had him lying in a gurney, wrapped in white sheets, with IVs coming out of him, and surrounded by medical personnel. And when I was at the execution of Benny Demps, I shuddered because it was so familiar. And the way we kill those whom we detest should never resemble the way we kill those whom we love. Lethal injection is a very bad method. It tends to lead us to conflate medicine with punishment, and the two are very separate. And so it would be fine with me if this particular case of McGuire, who, let's not forget, brutally raped and killed his victim, Joy Stewart, and stabbed her, at least penetrated 4.5 inches into her throat in the stabbing. He put her through unspeakable pain and suffering. So even if it's outside the bounds of consciously devised punishment to make him die painfully, if it is, nevertheless, there's a certain poetic justice if he died in pain, agonizing pain, when he did that to his victim. So the case doesn't trouble me extraordinarily if he did in fact die in pain for a few minutes, and hopefully it will spur us to do what apparently two states already making preliminary moves to do, which is to substitute for lethal injection the firing squad as the method of execution.
Exactly. Well, that's you probably all remember Gary Gilmore from my home state. He was shot with a firing squad, and the bullet didn't cost very much, and he seemed to die fairly quickly. Beth Karras from Wild About Trials, do you know much about the victim? Wasn't she pregnant? Wasn't Dennis McGuire's victim also pregnant?
Yes. That's the only other fact that I really know to add to what Robert just said, was that she was also pregnant, which, of course, just makes it all the more egregious. I'm not sure how pregnant she was, though.
Eight months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was he convicted of a double homicide? Did Ohio recognize that as a second person?
I don't believe so.
I don't think they did.
He was convicted of aggravated murder, rape, and kidnapping of her.
Okay. I almost called
but
you doctor again.
I've got.
Yeah, absolutely it should. Robert Blecker, we're going to talk with Beth Karras for just a moment. We're going to get back with you. Beth, you've interviewed Professor Blecker before, and you've read the book. Tell us your thoughts, what you felt about this incredible book, The Death of Punishment.
Well, you know, I think he just makes a very compelling argument and a totally different way of looking at our prison system. For me, I was always, when it came to the death penalty, I mean, I used to be for it, then I was against it, and I was on the fence, and I used to talk to friends of mine about it. One of my friends, who's an elderly woman who passed away, Diana Trilling, her husband Lionel Trilling was a literary critic. She lived up at Columbia. She's an author herself and really part of like the New York literary intelligentsia. And she said, well, you know, the death penalty is something you should be on the fence about because it's really a hard one. But the position Professor Blecker takes is really, I think, hard to refute, quite frankly.
I agree.
And, you know, I know he wants to change the dialogue, and I think that he's doing it. He's doing it with me.
Me too. I absolutely agree. And Beth, I'm like you. I've been, you know, against it for it. And Michael in Minnesota, same way, right?
Absolutely, 100%. And I am completely behind Professor Blecker as far as the suffering of that individual. If he suffered, so be it. I think of the victim. It always comes back to the victim. Most troubling to me, which we'll get into, I'm certain, is what Professor Blecker observed of these prisoners supposedly on death row. We in the public think that they are existing in a nominal, existing with a nominal existence of very little human contact, contemplating their crimes. And that's not the case, and I'm anxious to get into that part of the discussion. There is no justice for the victims, and it's really quite tragic.
Exactly. Professor Blecker, let's talk a little bit. Let's get into your life now. I want to kind of give a Reader's Digest version, if we can, about how you became this person to write this book. You were right in the middle of the 60s that you were kind of a hippie, if I may say so, and you opposed the war, but then you were so pro-death penalty that it made people not want to hang out with you. You weren't cool, you know, you weren't politically correct. But you have evolved into this. So kind of give us, like I said, kind of the shortened version of your life and how you came to write this book.
Well, as an undergraduate, as you point out, I was locally involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement, until I was ostracized on the basis of my views of the death penalty. But there was nothing to evolve from. My answer was very simple, which is that we were serving breakfast in bed to Richard Speck, the murderer of 8 student nurses in Chicago, rapist murderer, at the same time that we were dropping napalm on whole villages of innocent people in Vietnam. So my rejoinder to the anti-war set of which I was a part was, there's nothing inconsistent about being against the Vietnam War and being in favor of the death penalty. It's perfectly consistent. We're killing the wrong people. And so
Right. Even
then, for me, it was about killing the right people. I mean, ideally, we wouldn't be killing anybody. We wouldn't need to, and justice wouldn't be served if we did it. But if it's going to be, and it is in some cases, let's kill the right people, not kill the wrong people. Don't kill the innocent. So in that sense, my position hasn't evolved that much. I was in favor of the death penalty as a child without even knowing why, except that there was this figure, Adolf Hitler, who I knew deserved to die coming up as a child. And then as an undergraduate, as I said, I got ostracized from the anti-war movement over that issue. And then later, I was introduced to the great books of the Western world and hooked into the grand dialogue of the last 2,500 years and realized that really what it was all about back then and what it's still about today is the argument between Plato and the Sophists over over whether there are objective moral facts. Is there anything that is objectively true, which is what Plato held, or is it, as the sophists said, that it's true if that's our opinion? So if you take a sophistic point of view, I realize then and since, then one crime is worse than another only because we say it's worse, not because it objectively is worse. But my view is that the reason we say that murder is worse than petty theft is because it is worse than petty theft, and it does objectively deserve a harsher punishment. Well, I was struggling to get tenure at New York Law School and was writing plays at that point and wasn't writing about criminal law, which I was teaching because I didn't think I had anything interesting or novel to say. And a former teacher of mine, Phil Hyman, who was previously the head of the criminal division of the Justice Department under Jimmy Carter, sent me on a mission down into Lorton Prison to see what this new vicious drug, crack, was all about in 1986. Was it true that it was creating a generation of incomparably more vicious street criminals than we had ever seen? And Phil had a very important in, because a guy named Johnny Allen, whom he had represented, a robber, whom he had gotten off on an armed robbery, which Johnny in fact did, and then wrote Johnny's life story, assembled a series of tape-recorded conversations into his life story, assault with a deadly weapon. Johnny was back in the prison for having robbed a drug dealer from a wheelchair. Johnny was paralyzed from the waist down where he had been shot in the botched robbery. A cop had shot him in the spine when he was lying flat down and no threat, and I asked him how he felt about that, and he said, well, it wasn't right. You know, one thing to take out a guy in combat, another thing to take him out when he's helpless, but... And he paused. He said, I can't really blame him because my partner just killed his partner. So Johnny was had apparently bought some bad dope in the street and went back to get his money from the drug dealer. The drug dealer said, get out of my face, wheelchair, and you never called Johnny Allen wheelchair. So he pulled off a sawed-off shotgun from under the blankets that wrapped his lifeless legs and stuck it in the face of the drug dealer and said, okay, now you're going to give me back my money, now you're going to give me back all the drugs you got, and now you're going to call your older brother, and you're going to tell him to come down with $25,000 or else he's never going to see his little baby brother alive again. Mm-hmm. And so the drug dealer did that, and the one thing that Johnny never expected, he expected retaliation, they would attempt it, but he never expected them to call the cops. And they eventually did, and Johnny ended up back in prison, where they respected it enormously. Here's this paralyzed guy who had robbed the drug dealer from the wheelchair. So Johnny wanted to pay back his debt to Phil, and from Johnny's perspective, Phil was God, Phil Hyman, and Phil had sent me down to the prison, and so I was God's emissary, and so Johnny vouched for me as all right, you know, and that's 90% of it. And the other 10%, to finish the story in terms of how I got started in my prison travels, the other 10% of it was Phil called the head of the Bureau of Prisons, and who used to report to him when he was the head of the criminal division of the Justice Department, and said, I want to do this study, let this kid in, me, young professor, in, if you would. And he wrote a memo, the warden, the head of the Department of Corrections of the District of Columbia wrote a memo saying, let me in, let me talk to anybody I want in a private setting if I want, no guards present, and what's very important is I was allowed to have cigarettes and candy and a tape recorder. And so I had ideal conditions in which Johnny was vouching for me. Slim Rob was my prison name. Should only continue that way. He was vouching for me as all right. And, you know, to be all right, the guys had trust in me. They opened up, and 12 years later, you know, there I was with some clearer sense of who deserved what and why, because killings that even the killers condemn as bad killings tend to be very bad killings.
Absolutely. We're talking with Professor Robert Blecker. Professor Blecker wrote the book, The Death of Punishment. And in your book, I think one of what I love about it, one of the many things I love about it, is it really is a history lesson, too. You kind of go through history and you talk about certain things and certain aspects of history. And one thing you talk about is the war criminal Rudolf Hess. And I kind of got the feeling that this was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but kind of the first time your eyes were really opened to how well prisoners are treated. Now, this guy was in the Soviet Union, right? Wasn't he? Wasn't
no.
Hess in the Soviet? No.
No. Hess was in Germany.
Germany.
But
okay.
He was imprisoned as a war criminal. Hess was the deputy Führer under Adolf Hitler, who bailed out early in the war in some bizarre mission to convince Winston Churchill to switch sides or at least remain neutral and possibly form an alliance with Hitler. He was captured in Scotland and then imprisoned. Then after the war, he was tried as a war criminal along with some of the other leading Nazi war criminals. He expressed great admiration, continued to express great admiration for the Führer, and was the last one left alive inside Spandau Prison, which was in Germany, but jointly administered under the Four Powers Act, that is by the Soviet Union, the United States, Britain, and France. And everyone else had been released or had died. And so here is Spandau Prison with Rudolf Hess, its lone prisoner, in his 80s, in ill health, and a huge controversy arose as to whether Rudolf Hess should be compassionately released, because now he was an old man. And that's the first time. And by the way, I almost never agreed, and to this day rarely agree, with anything that the Soviet Union did or said, mm-hmm. and that Russia does or says. But Russia was the lone holdout. The United States mm-hmm. wanted to grant him clemency and release him. So did Britain. So did France. And the Russians didn't. Because the Russians said, and it struck me that they were fundamentally correct, that the past counted. That the fact that he was the deputy Führer under Adolf Hitler and never forswore any of the war crimes that were committed by him according to his ideology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, qualified him to be imprisoned at least, if not killed, to be imprisoned for the rest of his life. And, you know, we went through that compassionate release and just a couple of weeks ago, maybe it's even more recent mm-hmm. than that, the radical lawyer Lynn Stewart, did you follow this, who was tried and convicted for, she was representing some of the terrorists and tried to pass confidential information from
yeah,
to them, become
right.
a conduit, and
right.
she's suffering from, I believe, terminal cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was whether to release her, and they're going to, in compassionate release. My view is she mm-hmm. should not be released.
Because
those
of what
would,
she did.
Yes.
Because it was
yes.
so awful. But,
I mean,
okay.
it's not the body that dictates whether you get out. But what you were referring to was at the end, while they didn't release him, they made his prison conditions better and better and better so that he could walk endlessly in the gardens and try to make his life as pleasant as possible. And what I realized from that incident was that for them, the past didn't count. And that started me on that intellectual journey, or at least I shouldn't say intellectual journey, on that understanding that people who were administering prisons, and the former warden, by the way, called for his release, that for them the past didn't count, that the person they saw was a very different person and one that they would focus on, and what they would ignore was the crime that he committed. That is, of course, a main theme through this Crime and Punishment memoir, through the Death and Punishment, because it goes well beyond the death penalty. It's not only about the punishment of death, or even primarily, although it's largely about it, it's also about primarily it's about the death of punishment. It's that
exactly.
Nobody's job is to punish.
Let me take the side, if you will allow me, of somebody who is not for the death penalty. We're talking with Professor Robert Blecker. He has written the incredible book, The Death of Punishment. And you mentioned the young attorney, and I apologize, I forgot her name, but she was helping the terrorists, and she was caught. She's in prison now, and she has terminal cancer, and you say she should not be released. Here's what I know people would say. We are human beings. We should not lower ourselves to that level of getting even. We should be a higher person and have compassion in our hearts. What good does it do to make this woman die in prison? Shouldn't we, as human beings, have more compassion and let her out?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's a very revealing question that you ask, and the way in which you ask it is crucial. You ask, what good do we do by keeping her in prison? That is the classical utilitarian way of asking it or thinking. What good does it do? Predict, project into the future. It's all about the future. For those of us who are retributivists, the justification for punishment does not principally rest in the future good that it will do. It doesn't rest in the ways in which it might or might not deter. It doesn't principally rest in our need, in the terms of the death penalty, to incapacitate a dangerous criminal. It rests in doing justice because they deserve it. Look, we are a humane people. You don't deny her medical treatment in prison. You give her the medical treatment that she needs for her terminal illness, and you do give her the painkillers that she needs to ease her out into and let her die in as little pain as possible in this case. But you don't release her into the arms of the ones that she loved, and it becomes more difficult to make this argument, of course, because you can't concretely point to victims who she brutally killed. But take the same argument with the guy who rapes and murders a child, for example, and then is struck with terminal cancer and wants to be released into the arms of his still loving family. And you ask, should we do it? Why not? Compassionately and humanely. No, we shouldn't. He should never have any contact visits. He should never touch another human being. And because his body is breaking down does not mean that the spirit is broken down or the part of him that's responsible. His responsibility is not principally the finger that squeezed the trigger or plunged the knife. That was a body that did something at the command of a choosing a moral or immoral being. That's what you're looking to extinguish or imprison, not the body.
Very good point. We have Beth Karras with us. Beth, I'll come to you in just a moment. But Michael in Minnesota, you have a question for Professor Blecker.
Yes, I do. Well, when we're talking about this attorney, throughout your book, you talk about the worst of the worst. And do you really categorize her amongst the worst of the worst, the attorney with cancer? And if so, how? She didn't plunge a knife into anyone. She wasn't directly responsible for anything. She passed messages to criminals. But does that rise to the worst of the worst, in your opinion?
Oh, that's a very good question, Michael.
Thank you.
The fact that she didn't physically kill anybody, of course, can't be dispositive, or else we would have to agree that Charles Manson isn't the worst of the worst, and he is. Mm-hmm. And he didn't personally do the act. He orchestrated it and ordered it. So one doesn't have to personally plunge the knife into the victim. Again, in the case of Manson, a pregnant, among others, the victims included Sharon Tate, a pregnant movie star at that time. One doesn't have to personally do it in order to be the worst of the worst. If she is actively passing messages to facilitate an attack with weapons of mass destruction on the United States, then she does constitute the worst of the worst, or at least arguably she didn't get the death penalty. I'm not calling for it, absent some clear connection for murder, although the United States Supreme Court has outlawed the death penalty for everything but murder, with one tiny exception. They've left open the possibility that it's still available for treason. So you might argue that the worst of the worst of the worst, by the way, as Daryl Holton, the guy I got to know very well on Tennessee's death row, used to correct me, that I shouldn't be focused on the worst of the worst, but rather the worst of the worst of the worst. I would agree with you, Michael. She's probably not the worst of the worst of the worst. I'm not sure I would call for the death penalty for her. Possibly I would. I probably wouldn't, absent some clear connection with actual killings, although that can get us involved, you may or may not want to get involved in the discussion of the relationship between attempted mass murder and completed mass murder, whether somebody is
absolutely
as bad as Immanuel Kant insisted that the only truly evil thing is an evil will. And from that perspective, attempted murder is as bad as murder. On the other hand, there's no dead victim.
I didn't realize, I guess, that she was complicit in actually trying to precipitate instruments of mass destruction being introduced into the United States. I didn't realize that, and if that's the case,
no, I'm not saying, Michael, that's good.
Run.
No, that's a good point, and I'm not saying she did. I need to know more about the case. I'm not saying she did. I know she was attempting to pass messages to people who were members of groups who would, if they could, use weapons of mass destruction. That's not quite the same thing as the saying that you facilitate. Look, we go back to the beginning of the book when I'm a child, and they execute, the United States executes the Rosenbergs. And my mother's against it, and on the grounds, as the dyed in the wool liberal that she was, first of all, she found it difficult to believe that they had actually done it. Of course, it later turns out that they had. We know now from the confessions of Soviet spies that they were guilty of at least attempting. And my father's position was that anybody who attempts at least to pass the atomic bomb to Joseph Stalin any American who attempted to do that deserves to die, whether or not they were successful in doing it. Now, you know, it's a Lynn Stewart's case is tougher, but again, the question of what good will it do, in my view, is the wrong question. The right question, which may permit of different answers here, is what bad has been done and what is deserved for it? Not what good will we do, but what bad has been done and what does justice require as the reaction to it?
Let's go to Beth Karras. Beth, you've been waiting there very patiently, and you've already done an interview with Professor Blecker. It was fantastic, by the way. Do you have any follow-up questions before we start getting into some of the interviews that Professor Blecker has done and that we have the audio for?
Yeah, sure. First of all, Lynn Stewart, I think, Robert, and I may be wrong, but I think she got a 10-year sentence. We used to put her on Court TV. She used to be a commentator in the early days. Yeah. Very radical lawyer. Bill Kunstler, we used to put on air. Ron Kuby, he used to guest host, but they were all kind of together. In any event,
would you let her out early, Beth?
Sentence. Pardon me?
Would you let her out early, Beth?
Yeah, I don't know enough about her case. Probably not. You're very convincing. I probably wouldn't let her out.
Would you ever have let out Rudolph?
Really close to the end, though. I spoke to Ron Kuby not that long ago, and I think he was telling me about the case, but the decision has been made since then. I think she's in really, really bad shape right now, so she's not going to live much longer. That's my understanding. But anyway, back to you, Robert. Okay, so you had this amazing access, all right, for all those years, and the trust of these inmates. You were in a position that not many people are ever in, if ever, right, to have that much time, that much access, where you're not a lawyer representing or you're not a therapist doing an evaluation or, you know, for the court or for one of the parties. You know, how are we supposed to set up a system that can evaluate cases the way you were able? You were able to go inside and say this is how it should be done. What's the common denominator among these people? How are we going to evaluate if we can't get inside their heads?
Well, that's a good question also. Now, there are two ways in which from two large perspectives in which the system should be changed. And obviously, ideally, what we seek is case-by-case justice. We want to know more about each individual person. And you're quite right. There is a serious obstacle. That is, we can know as much as we can know. We can do better in death penalty cases, and we can do much better in potential life without parole cases. We have what we call super due process, which is supposed to attach to capital cases, which requires the defendant be allowed to put on the stand in the penalty phase when the only question is life or death. Not there are two phases, a guilt phase and a penalty phase. In the guilt phase, the question is what did he or she, mostly he, do, and did he commit first-degree murder to make him death eligible? In the penalty phase, the question is what does he deserve? Not what did he do, but what does he deserve? Does he deserve death or does he deserve life in prison? It's the penalty phase when we look to focus very much on the individual himself, and that's where your question, it seems to me, has the most bite, which is, and there, partly the answer is, we've got to provide adequate resources. Justice ain't cheap. Provide adequate resources, make sure there's competent counsel so that the defendant really does get to put on evidence about prior abuse. And virtues also about good deeds that the defendant may have done, about military record. That is, if for those who think that this is relevant and among the jury, they should hear about it. And too often we do have inadequate counsel. Now, I'm told and taken on belief from people I respect and people I've co-taught with, former defense attorneys, former capital defenders, that, for example, in some of the southern states, they've said, and I don't know this, I'm not verifying this, that in Mississippi and Alabama, sometimes there is inadequate counsel. I know in my experience in Connecticut, New York, and in places like that, the counsel is outstanding. They are appointed counsel, capital defenders, and they're well-heeled and very experienced. So anyway, the point is, we do our best with super due process, and we develop the mitigating circumstances. Now, we should offset that, in my view, and the United States Supreme Court's view is that we may offset it after they took a wrong turn for a while, with details about what the, who the victim was also, so that the jury can really strike a balance. But the other way in which we definitely can benefit by accounts and experiences of people like me who've gone in and investigated to the degree I have, is that the legislature, even before we get to the case-by-case analysis, the legislature defines what crimes are death eligible and defines the processes that it takes to establish them. And there, it seems to me, we've got a lot of ground to cover, a lot of improvements can be made, and we can use the experience that the book reflects of interviews with a couple of hundred convicted killers and street criminals and the officers who guard them in order to figure out what are truly the worst of the worst of the worst killings and what kinds of procedures we should apply in order to afford the killers the super due process that they should have before we either sentence them to die or, in my view, and what's not done today, also before we sentence them to life without parole. Look, for those 18 states who have abolished the death penalty, it's in 32 states today, life without parole is the most serious punishment that one can have, and they don't surround it by super due process. In fact, the ACLU just came out with a report, which I haven't investigated in full, but intend to at least fuller and have students helping me do this from the law school, in which they say that there are more than 3,000 prisoners serving life without parole in the United States today for nonviolent crimes. If that's true, it's a disgrace that we are making life without parole available as a punishment for those who are committing nonviolent crimes. And it's not just drug deals. They say they can document, and I want to find out. I'm in the process of trying to find out more. That includes somebody who stole some scrap metal dealer. I mean, life without parole, I mean, that's outrageous. Because if you're a retributivist, you're in favor of proportional punishment. Let the punishment
fit the
crime. Right?
These are probably three strikes.
Three strikes.
Yeah, probably. But if the other two aren't also nonviolent felonies, then I don't care that it's three strikes. You don't deserve life without parole. Life without parole should be reserved, if not for the worst of the worst of the worst, which perhaps is the death penalty, it shouldn't be available for nonviolent criminals. You can make life unpleasant for a shorter period of time and leave him hope if he transforms. Not life without parole. It's not proportional. Not when those same jurisdictions are giving people who rape and murder children life without parole. And especially not, and I hope we get into it, when those same jurisdictions are creating a quality of life inside the prison day to day that does not distinguish between someone who's a three-time burglar, convicted burglar, or a three-time convicted drug dealer where there's no evidence that anyone got injured or killed. Day to day, they will experience a life inside that is indistinguishable from convicted killers. That's the shame of it all. That's what the death of punishment is about, separate from the punishment of death.
Exactly, and we will be getting into that. We're going to be playing some amazing audio, courtesy of you, Professor Booker, of some of these killers who are having a hell of a time behind bars, just loving it. So we'll get to those audio clips in a moment, but Michael in Minnesota has a question, and then we'll turn to the audio clip. So go ahead, Michael.
Yes, I think it's interesting from your book, Dr. Blecker, or Professor Blecker, that...
Sorry.
And here I'm trying to get rid of the medical model of punishment.
I know. Look at what we're doing.
I know. I'm sorry. Anyway, you talk about how prison guards don't even take into effect what the crimes are that these people are in prison for. They just see them as another person, and they're there to keep peace, to keep the officers, their fellow officers safe, fellow inmates safe, and whatever the crime they've committed, while they may have knowledge, they do not make that part of their day-to-day existence as correction officers overseeing these prisoners. And I find that just appalling. I think, again, that we need the punishment to fit the crime committed. And when you talk about these death penalty, these people on death row who are out sunning themselves and playing volleyball and playing chess and having a great time and reading books and able to be out in the sun for 4 hours. And it's appalling because we, the public, think once a person is on death row, they're sitting in their cell 23 hours a day without any access to another human being and are being reflective of the crimes they've committed, and that is actually not true. And that's, I think, just appalling.
Yes, I agree with you, and shocking, too. I mean, Trisha's got the sound bites, and some of them come from the officers making the very point that you just made. I don't know if she wants to play them, but I'm sorry?
We will be playing them, definitely.
But my first exposure to that came early on, because I started these trips in the 80s, and it came in part from a female officer. I never heard this repeated again, but there was a female corrections officer who said to me, I don't want to know what crime a guy committed, because if I find out that he's a rapist, I'm probably going to treat him differently, and I'm going to be either on my guard or else I'm going to be apprehensive, and they're going to pick that up, and that's going to leave me vulnerable. But aside from that, it's a much more widespread phenomenon where the officers split as to whether they want to know what a guy did or do know or not, but they're uniform about not caring what a guy did, except insofar as he poses a future threat. I mean, if you look at the way we divide our prison system, we don't do it into the harshest punishment or the most restrictive prison and the mediumly restrictive prison. We do it maximum security, medium security, and minimum security. Security, security, security. It's all about the future. And when you ask them, again, Trisha, I know, is going to be playing some of these, but you're probably better off playing them and hearing them from their lips, because that's how I heard it, and it was startling at first, and then it became just the uniform mantra. It's as if they all spoke with one voice, and we're talking about prisons in seven states, seven different departments of corrections, and dozens of corrections officers whom I've interviewed, and they all say the same thing.
Let's go to one of those officers. This is from the Deputy Warden of the Oklahoma State Penitentiary. This is Cameron Harvanek. Is that how you pronounce that, I guess?
He pronounced it Harvanek, but...
Harvanek. And he basically just wants to keep the prisoners happy. And we'll ask for your comments in just a moment, Professor Becker. Here we go.
Is it your job to do justice?
No. Our job is just to follow the law. I mean, the judge says that this man's got the death sentence, or the judge says that this guy's doing 20 years or doing life without. Our job is to make sure he does the 20 years, or our job is to see that the death sentence is carried out. Our job is not to punish or do anything.
So you're not angry?
No, I'm not angry.
No matter what a guy did?
No.
If he killed children, you're not angry?
I mean, personally... Yeah, there's probably some inmates out here that you see what they did, and you think, my God, somebody will just put a bullet in their head and be done with it. But as a person or as an employee, when I come to work every day, I talk about flipping a switch. You know, I turn a switch on that says, okay, I'm at work. These people are human beings. It don't matter what their crime is, they're still people. They deserve fair treatment. They deserve the you know, like I said, the quality of life while they're in here.
Do they deserve to laugh and play ball? And
When those guys are out playing softball, they're not inmates while they're playing that softball game. The convict rules and everything, they're kind of put aside. If I slide into second base and I knock inmate Jones down and I hurt him, that's part of the softball game. But if I was to walk by and up to inmate Jones and knock him upside the head or push him over, not during that game, then all of a sudden we've got a problem. Those activities and things are a good release for them, and it takes pressure off, not only off themselves, but it takes pressure off the staff as well. The crazy thing about it is, and this is why I tell people all the time, I say, well, how can you work out there at the prison with all those people, you know, the inmates that are out there that have done all these bad things? I said, thing about it is it's a lot easier for me because I know what I'm dealing with every day. And I said, when I'm in line at Walmart, I don't know who's standing behind me and what they've been up to.
Professor Blecker, do you see his point? I think there would be somewhat of a good point there. The deputy warden of the Oklahoma State Penitentiary, he's saying, hey, look, it releases steam. Then I don't have to worry about them, you know, attacking people in the prison. What is your response to that?
Oh, well, I understand why they do it. They do it as a function of their officially declared mission, and they do it because it's more efficient prison administration. If you look at the mission statements of the Departments of Corrections in the 50 states, each one declares what its mission is. And, of course, the mission statement is supposed to guide the actual administration of the prison. And you read the mission statements in the 50 states and the federal government, not a single one so much as mentions the word punishment. Not one.
Mm-hmm.
The word punishment never appears in any mission statement in any Department of Corrections in the United States. The missions talk about primarily safe, secure facilities. We want to keep the facilities safe. That is, safe for the public, safe for the staff, that the inmates won't attack the staff. Now I'm starting to talk their language, that the prisoners won't attack the staff. And, of course, keep the prisoners safe from each other. Safety, safety, safety. And then, secondarily, we want to prepare them to reintegrate as productive members of society. But principally, we want to incapacitate them so that they won't commit crimes and the public can be kept safe. So insofar as the Departments of Corrections staff is guided by their mission statements, then, of course, no part of their job is to punish. And then when you go to the administration of the prison, yes, of course I understand his point. They're human beings. And they, and when I say they, I mean so are the prisoners. But let's talk about the staff for the moment. They want to go home at night. They don't want to be looking behind their backs all the time and worry about getting stabbed in the back. There's no better way of conducting a safe administration of prison than to substitute for punishment privileges. That's the new regime. It's no one's job is to punish. What they do is their threat is we will revoke your privileges. And you've got, I think you have some sound bites about that too. So do I understand what they do? Of course I do. Of course I do. If you have the one from Lee Mann, I would urge you to play that.
I was going to play that. Yeah. In fact, why don't we go to Lee Mann? That was the next one I was going to go to.
Oh, good. She said it better than anybody.
Absolutely. Warden's assistant at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary, Lee Mann.
Televisions are a management tool. Televisions are something the staff can allow or take away. And if inmates know that they're just one infraction away from losing that television for a year, sometimes they will think twice before they assault someone or commit a rule violation. It becomes a very effective tool for the officers. Without that tool, the officers are in jeopardy. We want time to make the time as easy for them as we can, because it makes it easy for us if it's easy for them.
There you go. She said it all. If they're happy, we're happy, basically, right?
We want to make the time as easy for them as we can, because it makes it easy for us when it's easy for them. That's it in a nutshell. So, of course, I understand it. They want to make it easy for the inmates because they're making it easy on themselves. They want a quiet, peaceful environment in which people do what they're told, and it all makes sense except for one thing.
What's that?
There's no justice. The punishment
doesn't
fit the crime.
But okay, right. But how do we fix that? And I'm going to go to Beth Karras, because I know Beth has to leave in just a minute. But Professor Blecker, how do you fix it? I mean, what do you do? I don't know what the answer is. I don't know how you fix that.
In my view, the answer is for the least serious criminals. First of all, for those who are ill and are committing what some of the prisoners called, I think very aptly, man-made crimes. Mm-hmm. That is, there are crimes, certain substances that they're dealing are crimes because we've outlawed them. We haven't outlawed them because they're particularly worse than alcohol or tobacco. For those people who are sick, who are addicts, we shouldn't be punishing, we should be treating. For those who are committing less serious crimes, we should be designing a system of punishment that doesn't principally measure on the basis of how long the sentence is. that's a turn we took. That is, in the Enlightenment, where liberty became the great good, we thought we could chop up liberty into units of time and somehow match the seriousness of the crime with the number of units of time that you're going to lose your liberty. But it's not just about how long it is. It's about how it's long. That is, the reality of punishment is the day-to-day experience of it. And so the short answer to your question is we redesigned the prison systems so that the day-to-day experience inside prison is a reflection of the seriousness of the crime that you committed, not merely and not principally the threat that you either continue or don't continue to pose. Because often the most serious criminals out there, the ones who prey on the elderly and the lame and the helpless and the children, are the biggest cowards. That's why they do it. And then once they're captured and confronted with overwhelming state power, the cowards that they are emerge and they become compliant. They become little well-behaved pussycats. And so you put them in prison and they become the best behaved prisoners, the model prisoners. And you hear the officer say, he's a good prisoner. I know what he did, or I don't care what he did. All I care is how does a man act toward me once he's inside. He's a good prisoner. Well, so we've designed a system that reflects the quality of life on the behavior of the prisoner once he's inside and severs it from the nature of the crime he committed. So what I'm calling for in the book is to reconnect crime with punishment by redesigning prisons so that prisoners who commit the most serious crimes have the most unpleasant daily experiences inside, regardless of how long the sentence is, and prisoners who commit less serious crimes should be given opportunities to rehabilitate, should be reintegrated in society, should have a meaningful, though punitive, prison experience. But we don't do it now. We're completely indiscriminate. We're indiscriminate in the way that we define crimes, and much worse than that, we're indiscriminate in the way that we punish them or don't.
Let's go to Beth Carroll.
I'm sorry.
Michael, I'll go to you in just a minute, Michael, okay? I need to go to Beth because Beth needs to leave. And we're talking with Robert Blecker. He wrote the incredible book, The Death of Punishment. And with us, we have Beth Karras. And Beth, I wanted to catch you before you had to leave. If you have any final comments or questions for the professor, we'd love to hear from them.
Well, I do have a question, and I'd like to know the reaction to your book. Who is supporting your view? Who's against it? What are you getting out there?
I'm getting individuals writing to me saying, some saying that I'm sadistic and shouldn't be corrupting young minds in any academic setting. Others thanking me for being a voice and articulating what's their voice. You know, it's funny because in the university settings or in the law school settings, especially in the Northeast, I'm treated like a pariah in the sense that I'm so out of step, although I'm tolerated by my colleagues, I'm out of step with the vast majority of their views. And I say to them, it's you. You don't understand. I may be in the minority here, but I'm very much in the heartland of America. And so the reactions, I mean, the media is by and large left-leaning and abolitionist, and so they're not especially embracing it. The New York Times passed on reviewing it as a book, although they've reviewed 20 books on the other side, none on this side, which is not a great surprise to me. Hopefully they'll relent. Somebody like Lou Dobbs on Fox has put me on, although Fox Mainstream has not. Yet, I mean, there's increasing. Unfortunately, the book is being seen too much as a book about the death penalty, which it is in part, but it's much deeper than that. It's about the death of punishment, not the punishment of death only. So, you know, what's the reaction been? Support in some quarters, generally favorable in terms of the way it's written, that it's a very interesting read, which is really not to my credit. It's to the credit of the guys I've met over the years and the people I quote. I mean, these sound bites that you're playing are drawn from the book, and it's just hopefully helping further bring it alive. But it hasn't yet changed the national conversation. It's going to be a grind. This is not going to be an overnight bestseller if it ever becomes one. It's not the selling that's important. It's the penetrating into the consciousness of America and rethinking. You know, the preamble to the United States Constitution, I know this isn't a direct answer to your question about the response, but it evokes it. The preamble of the United States Constitution, parts of which almost everybody remembers, a more perfect union and general welfare and common defense, and it said the blessings of liberty to our ourselves and our posterity. But the one everyone seems to forget is that the second purpose of the United States Constitution after a more perfect union is justice. What about justice?
Right.
So I'm hoping, Beth, I'm hoping that it changes the conversation. So far, it may have altered it a little bit. You know, those of you, I mean, for example, you folks have been very kind to me and said you read it and it's profoundly making you rethink it. And I've gotten that from the people who are reading it, but not enough are reading it. I'm not concerned with how many people buy it, but I am concerned with how many people read it and think about it and react to it.
Well, that's why we're here, Professor Blecker, is we want to get people out there reading it as well. And Beth Karras, I know you have to run. Thank you so much. Where can we see you next? Are you going to be popping up anywhere, or should we just go to BethKarras.com and see what's happening?
Well, I may be on Jane Beliz Mitchell's show on Tuesday night to talk about Marissa Duvall. Her jury selection, or screening of jurors, actually starts Tuesday, but they have some hearings still toward the end of the week, so I don't know when openings and testimony will be, probably not till next week. That's the case in Phoenix. Marissa Duvall, facing the death penalty, she hammered her husband to death. He didn't die immediately. He died almost a month later of the skull injuries and complications related to being hammered repeatedly in the head. So Jane Beliz Mitchell, Tuesday night. At least that's right now.
Sounds good, Beth. Well, you know, we'll have you back on as soon as we can, okay?
Great. Thank you. It's really an enlightening discussion. I really respect Professor Blecker. So I will see you, Tricia,
thanks,
Michael,
Beth.
And Professor Blecker.
Yeah,
Take care.
Thank you, Beth.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, Michael, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just had to get to Beth because I knew she had to leave. So the floor is yours. I know you've got some amazing thoughts on what we just heard from these people working at the prison, how they say, hey, we got to make the prisoners happy, then we're happy. You know, then we don't have to worry about them. Michael, go ahead.
Well, as I was listening to that, of course, all I kept thinking in my own head is, just lock them up and throw away the key. What's the problem? They're not, they can't hurt anyone if they're behind the bars. Who says they have to go play a softball game to get their aggravation out? You know, do push-ups and sit-ups in your cell and run in place or do whatever. You did the crime, do the time. Something that struck me in the book, too, was this reward system where the worst of the worst, they start out, you know, incarcerated, but like he said, they're cowards. So they're the ones that turn into pussycats behind bars. All of a sudden, even when they've been convicted of crimes behind bars, if they correct that behavior, they can end up being in an office in charge of weapons, with weapons at their disposal. It's just amazing and wrong. So the reward system, first of all, I think has to be eliminated for the worst of the worst of the worst, if we want to go that far, and maybe even the worst of the worst, because it doesn't obliterate their crime because they're acting like a pussycat behind bars. The victims are still victims out there. I happened to call in the best show when Dr. Blecker was on there, and all I wanted to know is, what can I do? What can we do? And Dr. Mm-hmm. Blecker said, write to your state legislators. But it doesn't feel like enough. I want to help Dr. Blecker or Professor Blecker with whatever we can do to get this national dialogue going, because it's an important, important discussion.
Boy, is it ever, Michael. And what I'm going to do right now, and this is going to, if you have blood pressure pills, take them now, people, because I'm going to play you something that Professor Blecker has been talking about all night, and that is how much some of these worst of the worst of the worst are enjoying their life behind bars. The audio I'm going to play is from a James, is it Perroquet? Is that how you pronounce this, Professor Blecker?
Perroquet.
Perroquet. James Perroquet. He has sexually abused and murdered a young boy. He was released on parole after doing that. He murdered again, and now he's serving life without parole in Illinois. Here you go. Get ready. You're going to be so angry.
Just give me a sense of your day. You wake up. What happens?
Well, I wake up. I clean myself. My cellie usually goes to work. And I don't go to work until 1 o'clock. So I got the cell to myself. If the cell needs cleaning, I'll sweep, clean the floor, wipe the walls, the bars, and everything. And flip on TV, see what's going on. Check out the news in the morning. Then after the news, I'll turn on the radio, listen to some music while I'm cleaning up. And then close, about an hour before work, I usually sit down and watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Try to answer the questions, you know. And then after that's all over with, I go back to the news until I go to work. Then I go to work. I work on the line in the kitchen. I go to the kitchen. First thing I do, I set up my line. After I get the line set up, I go around, try to put together something to eat other than what they are making. And about 4:30, they start running lines. I'm out on the line until they finish. When we get done serving everybody, I end up going back to the sale house, take a shower, go in, and watch some prime time, and then go to bed. 24 was a prime time. It was on Monday night's Prison Break. Lost, I watched that. I like Crossing Jordan. Doc. I like Reba McEntire. There's just a whole bunch on. Now everything's coming up with their season finales, and I'm just trying to determine which one I want to watch the most. I'm a Cub fan. I'm more of a Cub fan than anything. I'm a Bear fan. I'm a Bulls fan. You know, and that's who I cheer for.
And do you get to see the Cubs, and do you get to see the Bulls, and do you get to see the Bears?
Yeah, not as much as I like sometimes. A lot of Cub games are in the afternoon when I'm at work.
And there you have it, my friends. Professor Blecker, it is infuriating. That's what you're talking about. Now, this guy, this James Perquet, I can't remember how you pronounced it.
Yes.
I want to say again, sexually abused and murdered a young boy, then was paroled for that crime, and then murdered again. He's now serving life without parole. If it were up to you, Professor Blecker, what would you have this guy be doing every day, and what would his cell look like?
No TV.
Yes.
No, that's correct. I mean, Michael's correct about that. He wouldn't be playing. I mean, that's the essential point. And Michael made that point, too. I mean, playing. And so did the deputy warden. He said, when these guys are playing softball, they're not inmates. They're playing softball. And he's, of course, right. They're allowed that escape. These guys shouldn't be playing. The concept of play is antithetical to what their experience should be like. They should never play. That doesn't mean that they don't get exercise. They get exercise because we can't foreshorten their lives unless we're condemning them to die. You can't surreptitiously create a prison system in which you're pretending to give them a life sentence, but that life sentence is really a death sentence to be administered slowly or quickly. So you've got to let them live out their lives. But that doesn't mean they get to play. They don't get to play, and they don't get the arts and crafts. If someone who rapes and murders a child should never again touch another human being. No contact visits, ever. No group recreation, no play, exercise, but no play. I mean, I go further in the book, or the book goes further, and it calls for. And again, remember, this is just for the worst of the worst, or the worst of the worst of the worst. It calls for something I call permanent punitive segregation. And that would include their food being not what these guys' food is, but rather Nutriloaf, which is a tasteless but nutritionally complete patty. It's tasteless.
Yep.
So you don't get that wonderful pleasure from a variety of menu options and foods that change. You don't get that. You don't get the Hershey bar that I talk about on death row on the death row cell of Stephen Hayes, who was one of the two who broke into the Pettit family and house, and bludgeoned Dr. Pettit and then raped his wife and strangled her and then raped his 11-year-old child and took cell phone photos and tied his 11-year-old and his 17-year-old respectively to their beds for 6 hours, and then before they left, doused them in gasoline and burnt them alive. I mean, even the Nazis didn't do that. Even the Nazis killed you before they burnt you up in the ovens.
Right.
And I saw Stephen Hayes on death row, as the book talks about, and I didn't get a chance to talk with him because he was in the middle of his afternoon nap, and I was assured by the guards that he was doing very well in prison. He was adjusting well to his sentence. But what I did see, what infuriated me was the Hershey bar. It was the color television set and the Hershey bar. That he would wake up from his afternoon nap. I mean, in Illinois, they're watching the Cubs, they're watching the Bears. You watch your favorite team. You take the, you know, you mentioned the football playoffs. They're watching right now as we speak, if the game is still on. They're watching it. And they're enjoying it. Look, I once watched the Super Bowl with a dozen or so convicts, most of whom were convicted murderers, and this was in D.C. inside Lorton Prison. And by the way, a bad place to be anything other than a Washington Redskins fan. One guy had the nerve to wear a Dallas Cowboys hat during a Redskins Dallas game when he got stabbed to death. But
oh my God!
I was watching the Super Bowl with these guys, and they had their packs of cigarettes bet on the game, and they were with their buddies watching and cheering and booing and all the rest. And I realized that if you opened the this was a dormitory situation. This was weird. I mean, Lorton was weird because it was dorms of 50 guys in a house together with no cells, many of whom were convicted murderers. But leaving that aside, because it's since closed. But the point was, if you gave them their freedom and you said, okay, you can walk, you get six hours of freedom, go wherever you want to go, many of them would have stayed right where they were with the same bet, with their same buddies, watching the same game. And in the meantime, their victims were dead and rotting, and the victim's family would never get 4 hours of peace without the stabbing pain and sense of loss of whom these guys had killed. This is wrong.
Let's do this. I want to play Robert Pitt, since we're on this topic right now. We're talking with Dr. Robert Blecker. Professor Robert Blecker, who has written the most amazing book. That's why I keep elevating you to doctor. It's called The Death of Punishment, and it will infuriate you. Not only is prison great for the worst of the worst of the worst many times, sometimes the worst of the worst of the worst commit an even more heinous crime to get back in. And that's what Robert Pitts has done. He's life without parole in Tennessee. And get ready to explode when you hear this guy.
I stabbed her because I didn't know if she was going to die from the hits that I administered to her. And I thought, this might kill her here. It's this done.
Why did you want that?
Because I wanted to make sure that I received a life without parole sentence.
Why did you want to receive the life without parole sentence?
Because I was homeless, and I got fed up with it. Working a regular job and just making $200 a week and not being able to pay my bills. You know, I'm working and I'm still on the streets. So I, you know, with the knowledge that the American justice system will give you a life without parole sentence for first-degree murder, that's what I did. I knew the courts would give it to me, and all I had to do was murder the person. So I did it. I mean, that was my plan. As far as her deserving anything, I don't know if that's... that might be something for God to answer.
Well, I mean, she had never done anything to you, is my question.
No. She was an innocent bystander. I sinned. I committed a sin. I commit sins every day. And I'll burn in hell for them.
Does that bother you?
No, it doesn't. I would not want to go to heaven for nothing. I hate God. I'd much rather burn for eternity than be around Him for 1 second. I'm a thug in nature. And shelters aren't me. Prison is much more me.
I want to point out that you can hear the pool balls in the background. Aren't they like breaking a pool game? Is that what they were doing, was playing pool, Professor Blecker?
Yeah, I mean, he loved to play pool, and those are the sounds of billiards, and I've got the video footage of him playing, and that's what you're hearing. Yes, he
so
confirmed
he
prison was better than he ever
great.
Expected. It was,
and
it
he
was,
killed
he
an
had accomplished
innocent
his
woman.
Goal.
He killed
yep.
an innocent woman to get there. So what would you do things like put pictures of the victims all over, take down their family pictures? Would you do things like that?
I would put pictures of their victims in their face but out of reach in their cell mm-hmm. so they had to look at it. I would do what I could to connect crime to punishment. In the cases in which we execute, I would, before the execution, I would be playing video of the victim's last birthday or early or other video that the family, the victim's family chose and pictures of them. I would reconnect crime with punishment. I would reconnect that to them, to the prisoners, and I would reconnect it to us so that we'd remember what we're doing and why we're doing it. I mean, the final scene in the execution was not at all about the victim. It was only about the person who was being put to death, at least in the executions that I know of and the one that I witnessed. The victim's not even there. It wasn't even mentioned. And so the whole system has to be rethought. What we do has to be rethought. We have to reconnect crime with punishment. You know, the irony is that it's not true that there's no punishment going on inside the prison. And by the way, the response should be stated, which is, and they say this over and over again, they being not only the prisoners, but more especially the corrections officers, they don't come to prison for punishment. Their coming to prison is their punishment. And but then if you explore with them, they're coming to prison. I mean, so is the car thief coming to prison. So that means that he should be punished as well as the and as much as the murderer. And then no. Their answer will be, well, it'll be a difference in time. Well, it's not always a difference in time. Some guys, they stack up the sentences, what's called running them wild, running them consecutively. Mm-hmm. So he may not have a life sentence. So he's got 150 years to 300 years. And it may not be for that serious a crime. He is a repeated felon. I understand that. And we don't want that. And maybe if you made the time slightly harsher, he wouldn't go back and do it again. But the fact is, he should not experience the same lifestyle as the worst of the worst of the worst. The reality of punishment, I repeat again, is the day-to-day experience of it. And in terms of completely disavowing punishment, there's no place they more clearly disavow punishment than on death row, because there the officers say, it is definitely not our job in any way to punish, because the punishment takes place, all of it takes place over there, and they'll point to where the chair is or the gurney is, and the over there. But then you say to them, well, but wait a minute. I mean, in the case of Tennessee, for example, when I started interviewing down there and with Darrell Holton, the Tennessee hadn't executed anybody in 40 years. So I would ask the officers, look, if their entire punishment takes place in the chair or in the gurney, and Tennessee hasn't executed anybody in 40 years, so what you're telling me is that they shouldn't be punished in any way. Since their true punishment, the only punishment that you will acknowledge, will never await them. Because they're
exactly
never going to get
right.
it.
They'll never get it. Michael in Minnesota, my wonderful co-host, I know you're chomping at the bit. You've read the book. You and I have discussed it, and it both makes us crazy. Your thoughts about what Professor Blecker has been discussing?
Well, obviously, this is among the worst of the worst that I've ever heard. And I had a personal conversation with Professor Blecker, and I don't know, anything can be said on Trisha's True Crime Radio, Dr. Blecker,
yes.
or Professor Blecker. So this Pitts is enjoying quite a social life behind bars, and his dance card is full. I don't know, how far can I go with this?
Well, I don't know it to be true. I only know what the officers told me, which is that he has quite an active sexual and social life inside the prison and is quite content. We actually didn't get into that, and I don't
know
it. He didn't say it, but the officers assured me that that was so.
Okay, so first of all, we have Charles Manson getting married. Then this guy has a great sex life. I'm telling you, I'm doing something wrong because I'm not getting anything. I'm not getting a date. let alone anything else. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and my interview, I mean, the officers, while they speak with one voice that it's not their job to punish, don't entirely agree as to how far you should go in reforming the system, but one of them, I pressed, and I was doing it sarcastically, tongue-in-cheek, which is, I asked him, how about a movie theater? And he said, well, a movie theater is really more than we want to go. And I said, well, we were talking about death row, and I said, well, how about a softball field? He said, no, a softball field is too extensive. It's tough to police effectively. I said, well, how about a tennis court? That's pretty confined. And he thought, he said, tennis court. That's, yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, tennis
and
court.
You're being sarcastic.
And I said, you're telling me, I was being sarcastic. Of course I was being sarcastic. I said, you're telling me that you would put tennis courts on death row? And he said, yeah. I mean, yes, that would seem like sense. I said, how about conjugal visits? And he said, conjugal visits are very important. They keeps the inmates focused on things going on in the outside world and keeps relationships and gives them something to live for. And it's just, I mean, it's Alice in Wonderland. I mean, I'm in, or, you know, Bizarro Land, if to take a Superman image. I'm in Bizarro World sometimes. I mean, I can't believe it. But I understand it.
Okay, we're going to even get more bizarre. We're going to get even more bizarre because I've got to play this audio. There's one more inmate, and this is Derry Lewis. He is without life without parole for murder. He's in Stateville, Illinois, and he's a big soap opera fan. Here we go.
See, I try and get up about 7:30 every morning. You know, we get one shower a week, so I wash up in my cell. You know, do a little laundry. My cellie works, so I clean up. I keep the cell clean since he worked. You know, figure that's the least I can do. You know, to make it more as much. You know, it's as comfortable as it can be. I watch my soap operas.
Which one?
General Hospital. That's my favorite.
How long have you been watching?
Years.
You watch it every day?
Every day. Religiously. Get to watch a little comedy, laugh. You know?
Wait, you got cable TV?
Yeah, you got 11 channels. TNT, TBS. ESPN 1 and 2.
You basketball fan?
Well, football fan. Diehard Bears fan.
Bears?
Yes, sir.
Tough team to suffer with.
It's my team. When they flying, I'm riding with them. When they sinking, I'm riding with them. My physical being is trapped. I can go nowhere. But mentally, I'm as free as a bird. I'm going wherever my mind will take me.
And Professor Blecker, author of The Death of Punishment, that is what we're talking about. That man's mind should not be as free as a bird and having a wonderful time. He should be looking at his victims and should not be watching the Bears and suffering with them. I don't know how you do it every day because I'd be so angry. I think I'd just make so many enemies because I would just lose my mind. And this is something that you work on constantly. How do you keep it from getting into your soul and interfering with your life?
Well, it does to some degree. And having written the book, and hopefully, I mean, I'm still struggling to have it penetrate national consciousness. But if it does and it takes off and has a life of its own, then I'm dropping out. It's time to move on and do other things that I really want to do and write about stuff that I really want to write. But in terms of anger showing, it does occasionally. It breaks through. I remember I was in two instances, they're in the book, but I was interviewing spray shooters. And spray shooters are guys who, as the name suggests, would take an AK-47 or some other machine gun weapon, and go past a corner, and there'd be a crowd there, and there might be one guy that they've got as a target, the guy they want to get, and they'll just spray the whole crowd, and whoever dies, dies. And that was going on a fair amount in the late 80s and mid-90s. You don't hear of it as much. I mean, it was going on in the 20s, too, the roaring 20s, in the days of Al Capone, etc. And anyway, I was interviewing, in two occasions, spray shooters, and I said to one of them, you know, you spray a whole crowd on a corner because there's one guy you want to get. Yeah. Do you ever think about the fact that some of the people you're going to hit and kill, they've got children, they got sisters, they got mothers, fathers, they care about them, they're going to grieve, they're going to cry, and going to miss them? I said, no, never really give it much thought. And I said, well, why don't you give it some thought? And this silence and the love between us was palpable. And again, you're talking about anger, you know. And my anger was probably showing. I can't. And anyway, so I said, well, you know, what do you think? And one of them said, SOL. Michael says you can say anything on your show. So
you can.
SOL
you can.
Stands, SOL
shit
stands
out of luck.
For shit out of luck. Right. You know, what do you think? How do you feel? Shit out of luck. And the other guy said to me, shouldn't have gotten in the way of my bullet. Now, that's a depravity. That's a wantonness, a coldness, a heartlessness, which in my view is the worst of the worst of the worst. It's about attitude. Mm-hmm. It's about their attitude. And in some jurisdictions, in order to get the death penalty or even to get life without parole, you've got to intentionally kill. Some of these guys didn't intentionally kill. They just didn't give a damn. They acted with a depraved indifference recklessness. And the United States Supreme Court has decided correctly, in my view, in a case called Tyson versus Arizona, that the intent to kill is not necessary for the death penalty, that a depraved indifference recklessness will do. Many jurisdictions reject that, and members, current members of the United States Supreme Court, in their latest opinion, Miller versus Alabama, which outlawed the mandatory life without parole, now not just the death penalty, outlawed mandatory life without parole for any juvenile in the United States. If you're less than 18, you cannot get mandatorily life without parole, no matter what crime you commit. Well, there's a separate concurrence that says, by two of the justices, that say that they would outlaw life without parole for any juvenile who did not intentionally kill. So that a depraved indifference recklessness would not even qualify in their view for life without parole for a juvenile. And for the dissenters in Tyson would never qualify for the death penalty, period. So it's, in my view, it's, we are morally insensitive to what we should be very sensitive to. We are morally indiscriminate toward what we should be discriminating about, which is identifying in advance by categorizing the worst of the worst of the worst, and the book does it, and one of the appendices offers a model death penalty statute which collects the wisdom, from such as it is, from the thousands of hours and 25 years inside the prisons in seven states that I've experienced, and translates it into what should be, in my view, a more morally refined statute that really goes after the worst of the worst of the worst, and then specifies more clearly the nature of the punishment that they should get day to day. That's what it's about. Let the punishment fit the crime.
Amen. Michael, Minnesota, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I wanted Professor Blecker to talk about felony murder. And it's interesting how you addressed this. Because, actually, I just saw a Dr. Phil show that had on three of four kids that had broken into a house thinking the resident wasn't home. And the resident was home. He came down armed. One of the intruders ended up being shot and killed. And they were all, by the homeowner, and they were all charged with felony murder. And so the mothers were on, and these kids from prison were on, and none of them felt it was just because none of them shot their friend. But the way the law is written, if a murder happens or someone dies in the commission of a felony, you're all guilty. And that includes the kid who made the conscious decision to not join in the robbery and was just standing outside across the street. But because he had a knowledge that they were breaking in, and there was a danger that the resident was home, he also was convicted. And they received sentences 45 to 55 years. And Sonny Hostin, a federal prosecutor, got on and said, not once have I heard anyone display any remorse for their friend when his blood is on their hands. This is classic felony murder. I had a hard time with that. I'm wondering, how do you feel about that?
I have a hard time also, and I get my hate mail from the right as well as from the left, and some of it often responds to my call in the book and publicly to abolish felony murder. I think it's a terrible crime as a crime. It's ill-conceived. It came about as an accident and on the basis of a misunderstanding out of 17th century English law that I'll spare you. But the essence of felony murder is that the intent to commit the felony through a fiction transfers and becomes an intent to kill, even though it isn't. For those people whom we need to, and whom we should get as murderers and punish as murderers, we have an alternative way of getting them. We take their culpable mental state and the causal connection. Now, to the crime. But if you accidentally kill in the course of and in furtherance of a felony or immediate flight therefrom, if you accidentally kill, then you're not as guilty as someone who intentionally kills. You're not as heinous as someone who intentionally kills. In the rule that you specified, Michael, that's even broader than the felony murder rule in New York. In New York, for example, it's limited to only burglary, robbery, escape, arson, kidnapping, and the sex crimes. And it's required that in the course of and in furtherance of, not or in furtherance of, in the course of and in furtherance of, he or a co-felon kills a non-co-felon, causes the death of a non-co-felon. So the case that you just referred to would not, in jurisdictions like New York, qualify for felony murder, because here you have a felon killing, you have a non-felon killing a felon, and that doesn't qualify, and that shouldn't qualify. The book goes on to draw, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I felt like it shouldn't either, especially the person who didn't want to participate and stayed across the street. Now,
exactly.
Obviously, he should have called 911 on his friends, but who does that really in a perfect world? I mean, you don't want to rat out your friends.
Correct.
The kids
and the book talks about
unarmed.
Yep, and the book talks about that. I mean, guys got caught up in situations. They either suspected they're going out to party and they want to get some pot. So someone says, I know where he can score some pot. So he's waiting in the car outside while his friend goes in. Now, he thinks his friend's going to buy it, and he's going to a drug dealer. He may suspect that his friend's going to rob it. He may. He may not. In a couple of cases, they didn't. They really had no idea. It was one kid who was home from his National Guard training. And he had no idea, no criminal record, et cetera. And he went with his friend and a new guy that his friend introduced him to. Well, that new guy went in to rob it and killed the drug dealer. And so this kid ends up with a life sentence from felony murder. He's not a murderer. That's part of the way.
Right.
The felony murder rule is terrible. The felony murder rule has put more people on death row than any other, where robbery is used as the aggravator. And the assumption is that if one kills in the course of a robbery, one is killing from a pecuniary motive. But that's not true. One is robbing from a pecuniary motive.
Mm-hmm.
The killing is something else. And I further draw a distinction, which I became, and many people reject as morally repugnant, but I draw it from the basis of these interviews, that if you rob a victim and the victim resists with deadly physical force, he's entitled to, he's allowed to resist. So let me be very clear about this. He's not committing any crime, he's not morally right, he's brave, but he may be stupid. But in any case, for doing it, in any case, if he resists and goes for his own gun, if he resists and goes for the robber's gun, and then he is shot and killed in the course of it, that's not as bad as when you kill a non-resisting victim, where you say, you hold the gun on him and say, okay, you know what time it is to stick up. And the guy hands it over, and then you kill him to eliminate him as a witness. That person is a murderer. That person is selfish. That person deserves the worst punishment for the rest of his life.
Right.
But if you're a robber and somebody goes for your gun and dies in the struggle, it's terrible, and you shouldn't have been robbing, and you deserve to go away to prison for many years, but you're not the worst of the worst of the worst. You do not deserve life without parole, and you do not deserve permanent punitive segregation. So the book is very much, and I'm very much, and retribution is very much concerned with not over-punishing as well as not under-punishing. It's about adequately and proportionate punishment.
And that's why
I find it interesting that you're meeting any resistance, because your arguments and your logic are so solid to me. And I'm very liberal, right? But everything you say resonates with, or very liberal left, I'm sorry. But everything you say resonates with me to my core. It has always bothered me that our prisons don't seem to be facilitating the kind of justice that we all think they should, bread and water. I'm glad you have introduced Nutrilof to the conversation. Mm-hmm. That's better than bread and water, but I would like to see it. It would cut down expenses, I would think. I don't know why. These people, these inmates with their color televisions and 11 cable channels, do they have to pay a cable subscription, or is that covered by the penitentiary? Do you know?
The cable is covered. The television is not. That's another fundamental injustice in the system. A guy goes, and this has been confirmed in many jurisdictions that I've visited, guy's inside, and once he's through receiving and discharge and has been placed in where he's going to be placed, he will have a TV as soon as he can afford it. Now, if he's got a lot of money coming in from the outside, then he can afford a TV right away because he's got enough in his canteen or commissary fund. If he doesn't have the money, he doesn't get it. Now, why is that? What does that have to do with the nature of the crime he committed?
Right.
Why should you talk about unequal justice on the basis that the rich get the better lawyers, which is not by any means true when it comes to appellate lawyers and death penalty cases, because all these very well-heeled lawyers who charge $800 and $1,000 an hour crawl out of the woodwork to assuage their liberal guilt and mm-hmm. become appellate attorneys for the condemned. But this simple injustice in terms of economic injustice, why should you get a television on the basis of how much money you can bring into the commissary? So that if you're wealthy, you're coming in, you get a TV, and if you're poor, you don't?
Hey,
I just don't
like
see any reason for any televisions. It's so wrong. It's counter.
Well, some people, in my view, would get televisions. Not convicted rapist murderers of children, mm-hmm. but burglars would get televisions.
Oh yeah, I could see that.
No,
I could see that. I really could.
White collar criminals, maybe, but even burglars.
Oh well, let's get to white collar. Wait, let's talk about white collar criminals. What do you want Bernard Madoff to get?
Nothing.
You want nothing. I happen to be a Madoff victim. In fact, I'm one of three generations of Madoff victims because my father-in-law was a good friend. My father-in-law's very dear friend was his father-in-law's brother.
Oh,
Bernie dear. And growing up, the mantra in our house was, don't worry about the kid's college education, there's always Madoff. And, of course, there wasn't always Madoff. But, you might remember, Bernie Madoff, so he took down with him my father, who was fortunately a prudent enough guy that he didn't invest everything. He was allowed to invest, even though he didn't make the threshold of other people in terms of the amount of money, because we didn't have that much money. But he was allowed to invest it because he was a dear friend of Bernie Madoff's father-in-law's brother.
Mm-hmm.
But Madoff wrote a letter from prison. I don't know if you remember this, about after his daughter-in-law, whose husband, Madoff's son, committed suicide, and Madoff wrote her a letter telling him about how great prison was and how what a good time he was having, and he was going to teach business courses and how respected he was and everyone looked up to him, and he had lost some weight and gotten into shape. He couldn't believe what good shape he was in. And, you know, there's a white-collar criminal, and my view is, and I published, I wrote a letter to the New York Times when they said that Madoff had been, the day that they said that Madoff was sentenced, and they said he had been sentenced to the maximum penalty. And I said, no, he isn't. Look at his lifestyle inside. He's not sentenced to the maximum penalty. If you want to sentence him to the penalty he deserves, he should be in prison cleaning toilets every day.
Absolutely. Absolutely, right.
And the editor of the Times called me and said, well, cleaning toilets really isn't Times style. How about he should be subject to unpleasant tasks? And I said, well, that sort of isn't the style that communicates what I want either. So we compromised for some strange reason that they found this was an adequate compromise, that he should be cleaning latrines. They didn't like cleaning toilets. And the weird thing about this incident was that I got an email from one of my colleagues who was the most left-wing, who never saw a criminal she didn't love, or a punishment that she embraced. But when it came to Madoff, she said, I saw your letter in the Times, and I absolutely agree with you, except I would have changed one thing. He should be cleaning toilets with a toothbrush. And,
absolutely. I love that woman. I love that. That's right.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't love the rest of what she stands for, but but in any case, you know, she who never gets angry at anybody, for some reason, Madoff, so got her goat. So, I mean, part of the attack on the system, I mean, there are people who, and Madoff isn't, well, if you argue about the suicides and the lost charity money, you could argue this. I call them, what you call white-collar criminals, sometimes I call red-collar criminals. And it was a phrase that I used in a Washington Post op-ed piece that I really hoped would catch on, and it never did. In red-collar criminals, that is, the collar is right, but the color is wrong. The guy, the corporate executives who dump PCBs into local streams, polluting them, and mm-hmm. people get cancer. The people who maintain deadly workplaces and their employees die. They're not white-collar criminals. They're red-collar criminals. No. The color's right, mm-hmm. but the color's right, but the color's wrong. It's the blood of their victims. And so, I'm not so sure I'm with you that I would so clearly separate.
I should have said nonviolent. Because you're absolutely
Well, is Madoff
right.
violent? Is Madoff violent?
No, but he was responsible for the ruin of, I don't even know how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of victims. We had our own here in Minnesota with Pettit, who did much mm-hmm. the same thing, only on a much smaller scale. But no mercy. If you're responsible for the ruination financially of families and generations, that's a degree of atrocity that needs some ultimate punishment. Probably not death, but certainly
no,
natural
not death.
Life behind bars.
Or
Professor
the
Blecker?
Enron executives? Yes.
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah, that absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about what we can do. First of all,
yeah.
what you the listener can do is get the book, The Death of Punishment by Robert Blecker. You will not regret it. I swear to you, it will keep you up at night. You will not want to put it down. But Professor Blecker, as Michael pointed out earlier, what can we do? Now, before you answer that question, I'm sorry, I meant to ask you this question first, then we'll get to the what you can do. Do you have an opinion about Jody Arias? A lot of our people that are on WebSleuths.com have followed the Jody Arias case closely. Now, they tried to get her the death penalty. The jury couldn't decide, so she's going to have another mini-trial to decide her sentence, either life without parole or the death penalty. Are you familiar with the Jody Arias case?
Yes, although maybe not in the depth and detail of some of your listeners, but yes, I am.
And what would you recommend?
Not death. I mean, Nancy Grace and I got into a disagreement about this on her show. Mm-hmm. I'm not in favor of death for Jody Arias. I don't think she's the worst of the worst of the worst. She had a relationship with this guy. I don't know how and why it went south. She didn't kill him to collect life insurance. She killed him possibly in a fit of anger and passion. It deserves to be convicted and was convicted of murder. But
premeditated murder.
Yes,
although, by the way,
well, let's talk about that for a moment. Premeditation is an aggravating circumstance in many statutes, and yet it shouldn't be. The great retributivist 19th century criminal court judge who was both a scholar, historian of the criminal law, and sentenced many people on his own to die, Sir Fitz James Stephen, a Brit, attacked the notion of premeditation as an aggravating circumstance and gave the following two examples, contrasted them. You have a wife who's abused by her husband, and he beats her repeatedly and threatens to kill her and abuses the kids, and she should leave him, but she can't. She just doesn't have the strength, and she agonizes over it and goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and eventually decides that she'll kill him, plans it, carries it out, and kills him. Contrast that. That's premeditated. Contrast mm-hmm. that, said Fitzjames Stephen, to a guy who's walking down a street, a road, sees a child fishing with his legs dangling off a bridge, and spur of the moment, and for nothing but amusement and sport, He walks behind him and pushes him off into the bridge to watch him struggle and try to swim and watch him drown as he drowns in the river. The first one is premeditated. The second one is sudden and spontaneous. The first one does not deserve the death penalty, though premeditated. The second one does, though spontaneous. And so Fitzjames Stevens' point was premeditation might actually be and is consistent with an agony of spirit and a back and forth and an internal dialogue. And sudden, spontaneous, non-premeditated killing can actually show a callousness, a heartlessness, a wantonness, and a cruelty that a premeditated killing lacks. So in my view, premeditation should not be the common aggravating circumstance that it is. You can have very passionate people who are emotionally involved in a relationship that's gone bad and kill, who are nevertheless premeditatedly killing it. The notion of cold blood and premeditation, though often identified, are not identical. You can
but
in fact
what about
be
the mutilation
something.
Of a victim when someone
yeah, but that can be,
has inflicted
right, but,
three yeah. Fatal blows in the as Jody did in the execution of Travis Alexander, doesn't overkill get into a heinous, depraved?
Probably,
she intended him to die. I mean, there
oh,
no
most
question.
Certainly, most certainly. This is not an instance of depraved indifference to human life. This is an instance of an intent to kill. But it all the overkill, as you put it, also bespeaks a certain fury and emotionally wrought. Killing. Look, it's murder. It's not manslaughter. I mean, the classic heat of passion, extreme emotional disturbance, reduces murder to manslaughter if there's a reasonable explanation or excuse for the disturbance. But the unreasonable explanation or excuse for the disturbance, the unreasonable explanation or excuse, can reduce it from capital murder to ordinary murder. So I know I part company with people who otherwise share perspectives with me on the death penalty. I would not give Jody Arias the death penalty. I don't think she qualifies for it. It's a one-on-one
wow.
killing. It's a one-on-one killing. And by the way, I also predict that she won't get it, but you didn't ask me that, but I predict it anyway. It's got to be, the way it works now. On the second round, it's got to be unanimous jury, and if it's not a unanimous jury for death, if there's even one holdout for life, it becomes a life sentence. The first time,
right.
If there was only one holdout, there was a new trial. Maybe. By the way, I already predicted wrongly, let me acknowledge, that she would never stand trial for death a second time, if the prosecutor wouldn't go death. I didn't think the prosecutor was going to go death a second time.
May I interrupt?
Wish, but,
yeah, let me,
yeah.
me interrupt
sure.
just a second.
I know,
okay,
I
so
see time
say,
is fleeting.
Oh, no, wait, hey, we got lots of time still. Don't we can go on and on. Let's say Jody Arias is found, it gets the life without parole. Professor Blecker, what would you do to her in prison? What would you let her have?
Not too much. I know that's a vague response.
She should be treated as the worst of the worst, don't you agree? I mean, I would like to see anyone who murders get the Nutriloaf and solitary confinement and a picture of their victim, hopefully alive and also after slaughter, out of their reach so they can reflect on what they've done for the rest of their natural life.
I'm with you there.
Is that something for Jody? Is that something for Jody Arias, do you think?
I guess, although it doesn't cry out to me in the same way that some others do. I have to tell you,
you've seen the worst of the worst of the worst.
Yeah, you've seen, yeah. I mean,
the worst of the worst of the worst.
The stuff that you have seen looked up.
But again, this was the product. Now, if you told me that she took out an insurance policy on him and then killed him, then we've got a whole different story. Then she dies.
Right. Right.
In my view. And if she doesn't die, if she's spared, then she gets permanent punitive segregation. But if this really was a one-on-one killing and the product of an emotional and sexual relationship, which the relationship was consensual and longstanding, then there's too much there that I don't know, and there's too much involved in human emotion and passion that certainly leads me to reject the death penalty. if you're really going to save it for the worst of the worst of the worst. See, that's one of the terrible things about the public opinion polls.
Mm-hmm.
The famous Gallup poll question that they've been giving since 1938 or 6, one of the two, is, are you in favor of the death penalty for someone convicted of murder? Well, how am I supposed to answer that? The answer is no, 90 to 95% of the time. The answer is yes, mm-hmm. 5 to 10% of the time. So what am I? Say no? Or do I
right.
say yes?
You have to have more information. More information.
You do?
Absolutely.
And in fact, interestingly enough, in another poll, African Americans more frequently than Caucasians refused to answer the yes or no and added, even though they weren't given the option, the words, it depends.
Well, that's
true. And they're right. It depends.
100%.
I can't answer that. And the polls never list, or at least the Gallup poll, never lists the nature of the killing or the particular murder, never distinguishes
mm-hmm.
them. And if you ask the American people, and even then, the most recent Gallup poll still has 60% of the American public supporting it, and of course the headlines read, support for the death penalty is the lowest in 40 years. And then you probe a little bit about that in that Gallup poll, and you notice there was a second question that none of the newspapers included in there, or I should not, probably overstating it, that few, if any, of the newspapers included, and certainly nobody highlighted it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, they asked the same group, the same sample, of which it was a 60% in favor, and I forgot what percent no opinion and the rest opposed, they asked them, they gave them a choice, one of three choices. Do you think the death penalty is used too often, not often enough, or about the right amount of time? And if you add those who said it's not often enough to those who said about the right amount of time, who, after all,
mm-hmm.
those two categories taken together are death penalty supporters. It's used about
right.
the right amount of time, or it's not used often enough. It should be used more often. Instead of 60%, you get 72%.
Interesting.
But that one wasn't mentioned in the liberal media. Nor was the latest Angus Reid poll, which was taken right after the Boston Marathon bombing,
mm-hmm.
which asked, you support the death penalty, where that was on people's minds. And by the way, a poll, very well-respected poll, which more accurately predicted the presidential election than almost every other major poll, including the Gallup poll. And the Angus Reid poll came up with something about 80% support for
wow.
the death penalty. And if you Google them, you will find within 3 or 4 days, Dudley Sharp did this study, within 3 or 4 days after the polls came out, the Gallup poll came out, there were something like 400 Google hits to the Gallup poll and zero to the Angus Reid poll among American
really?
Media outlets.
Oh,
well, that's
geez,
just
that's
because they don't know. That's probably because they're not aware of the Angus Reid poll.
This is a major polling organization, or even leaving aside that, the fact that the headline in virtually every media that covered it was death penalty drops to the lowest, support for the death penalty drops to the lowest in 40 years. And nobody
mm-hmm.
referred that I read, I'm sure somebody had, but nobody referred or prominently referred to the second question,
mm-hmm.
which
right.
was too often, about the right amount of time, or not often enough.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of us, Dr. Becker or Professor Becker, Patricia, I could shoot you for putting that doctor in
the head. I love it. I love when you do that.
Believe me, I've been called worse.
I think that the part of the those of us who, like Beth and I have discussed this at length, but who tend to favor the death penalty for the worst of the worst, but we're kind of on the fence, I think we can attribute some of our lack of conviction on things like the Innocence Project that have shown so many innocent people who have been spared life without parole or even death because of their innocence. And the thought of killing the wrong person for a crime is really unsettling. And so I think that is the biggest frustration amongst those who are maybe questioning the validity of the death penalty. What if we're killing an innocent person? Do you want to speak to that?
Sure. First of all, as a retributivist, it's a horrifying thought. It is absolutely a horrifying thought, and there's no justification for it. A utilitarian perspective could, of course, justify it, and some essays have. In one by Sunstein and Vermeil, they talk about life-life trade-offs. That is, suppose it turns out that we, on very, very rare occasions, do execute an innocent person, but that the death penalty has a uniquely more effective deterrent value than does life without parole. Suppose it turns out, as some studies suggest, although others suggest otherwise, that we actually save seven innocent victims who otherwise would be victims of murder for every death penalty administered to somebody because it stops other would-be killers or it stops those whom we parole, etc. If it turns out that we actually save more lives than we take, and yet we take innocent lives wrongly through the death penalty, then a strict utilitarian doing a life-life trade-off analysis might say, look, it's horrible that we're occasionally killing innocent people, but we're actually saving more innocent lives than we're taking by the unique deterrent value of the death penalty. Now, I reject that as an adequate reason to support it because I'm not a utilitarian. It's not the question, again, is sort of
Professor, what is a totalitarian and the other thing that you're calling yourself?
Utilitarian.
A utilitarian
essentially, I mean, this is Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, Jeremy Bentham, John Stuart Mill, and many people today. A utilitarian essentially holds, first of all, that the ultimate good is pleasure, the ultimate evil is pain. Pain is bad, pleasure is good. Secondly, that we are rational, calculating, and we tend to maximize our pleasure over our pain. So that in making decisions, we will choose a course of conduct that allows us to project, once we discount for how swift the punishment will be, how certain it will be, and how severe it will be, we'll get a present expected value, we'll weigh it against the pleasure, the near certain pleasure we'll get from the crime, and if and only if the pain of future punishment discounted by its probability and its swiftness and its severity still outweighs the near certainty of the present pleasure we'll get from committing the crime, will we be deterred? So the utilitarian is all forward-looking and justifies punishment by deterrence, by incapacitation, etc. The retributivist, which is what I am, someone who embraces retribution, rejects the utilitarian view that the future is what counts, rejects the question of what good will it do, rejects the attitude that says you can't cry over spilt blood because the past is the past and you can't change it, and says independently of that, of the future costs and future benefits, that the past lays claim, that we make a covenant with the victims, that we make a covenant to the past to do justice. Now, from the utilitarian point of view, that is not rational, and they tend to dismiss us retributivists as irrational. And to a degree, they're correct in the sense that it is not rational. That doesn't make it irrational. It makes it non-rational. It partakes of a realm that is richer than strict rationality. It's real, but it requires an emotional connection, as does, in my view, every moral question. Adam Smith, who was more famous for The Wealth of Nations as the great capitalist spokesman, was in his lifetime more famous for a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is the great retributivist Bible, in essence, a book on retributive psychology. And Adam Smith, points out that at base, every moral question is emotional. And B, he says, and he's quite right, imagine yourself in the victim's shoes. Imagine that the victim could somehow look down and see what's happening. How would the victim feel? And I do that. I imagine that these victims looked down and saw these guys playing volleyball and saw the arts and crafts room on Tennessee's death row with the huge color television set playing the Tennessee Titans game in the background. I imagine how the victims would feel. And the victims, I believe, would be writhing in agony and saying, this isn't just. How can this man who raped me and killed me or just killed me or tortured me, etc., 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 how can we be having him play volleyball? Right. That's not strictly rational. But it's real. And it's right. And so we retributivists are not about only the strictly rational. Look, I use a metaphor from mathematics. The real numbers are incommensurably richer than the rational numbers. You cannot express the square root of 2 or pi as any ratio. It is not rational. We've known that since the 6th century BC with Pythagoras. Just like the real numbers are incommensurably richer than the rational, so real justice may be incommensurably richer than strictly rational utilitarian justice. It requires emotion.
Don't you
feel,
though?
Informed emotion.
Informed emotion, very true. Don't you feel, though, if we, let's just say that America came together and said, okay, this is the way to think. The Death of Punishment, great book, it's changed our minds. But now you have to decide. Don't you think it would be almost impossible to decide who gets what, when, and how? Or do you think it would be fairly easy?
No, I don't think it would be fairly easy. I think it wouldn't be that difficult to change it at a legislative level. That is, to specify in advance a more refined system of who deserves the death penalty, what's death eligible and or life without parole, and permanent punitive segregation. I advocate in the book a number of changes, including the burden of persuasion, which I think is wrong. We use in the penalty phase the same burden of, that is, whether it's life or death, whether it's to be life or death, we use the same burden of persuasion as we do in the guilt phase, but that is beyond a reasonable doubt. That's generally what we use, and I think that's wrong. The United States Supreme Court has rejected what's called residual doubt. That is, if the jury, there are those who advocate, and I agree with them, there are those who advocate that a jury that does not, that still has a lingering doubt, it's sometimes called lingering doubt or residual doubt, even if it's not rational, even if they can't give a reason for it, but there's just something in them. They were convinced enough to convict, but they're just not convinced enough to kill. I think they should be instructed that even a lingering doubt should result in life versus a death sentence. Furthermore, I think that not only must they be convinced that he did it with no lingering doubt, but they must be convinced that he deserves it to a moral certainty. I would instruct that. So I would raise the burden of persuasion. I would allow what's declarations of life. Look, the abolitionists, the opponents of the death penalty, circulate these declarations. I've seen them. I have one. And it says, essentially, if I am ever murdered, no matter what the set of circumstances, no matter how I am killed, I do not want my killer to get the death penalty. Now, that doesn't give them an absolute veto, but it should give them a voice. That statement should be admissible. If Gandhi's assassin had been up for the death penalty, he shouldn't have gotten it, in my view, because that would be profaning what Gandhi stood for.
Right.
The victim's voice should count, and we don't. Those statements have never been admitted in any court that I know of at any death penalty trial. They should be admissible. Of course, if I want to sign a statement that if I'm ever murdered in these sets of circumstances, I do want my killer to get the death penalty if he otherwise qualifies under the state statute. That, too, should be admissible. We should reconnect with the victim. So to answer your question, would it be difficult? Yeah, of course it's difficult. Is it possible? It's possible to refine it further. Look, justice is a work in progress. We're not going to achieve it perfectly. And if people take the book to heart and translate it into social policy and into law, it won't be perfect. It requires collective wisdom. And we should always be uncomfortable as we kill, slightly. But, having said all that, some people deserve to die, and we have an obligation to kill them. And I am as certain of that as I am that my hand has 5 fingers.
And I'm going to let Michael in Minnesota wrap it up with a final question. Michael, what is your question, my dear?
Well, I don't know if this will be a final question. There's 2 questions, actually.
Okay.
We're all familiar with the murder of Polly Klass. It was a horrible, horrible case, and her killer is on death row, as he should be. What do you make, first of all, of this Canadian group that interjects into the United States penal system and takes up the causes of the worst of the worst of the worst to somehow try and garner sympathy and get these death penalties overturned for the very worst of the worst of the worst?
Yeah, the Canadian Coalition Against the Death Penalty. I had occasion to be what's called on the hot seat. If anyone checks out my blog, robertblecker.com, there's a link to that appearance, Test of Faith, it's called. And I was what's called on the hot seat, and they progressively brought more people to attack and oppose me, and he was one of them, the executive director of it. I know what you're talking about. They maintain a website, a free website for anybody on death row, and present them sympathetically. I've got a guy from Ohio who posted a notice on the website saying, please, I have more pen pals than I can possibly handle. Could you go somewhere else and contact somebody else? I think it's appalling. I really do. How much sympathy we tend to have. How these women, there are groups of women who devote themselves to death row inmates. They want to marry them. They visit them regularly. You know, as one of the, I think it was the prison chaplains pointed out to me, he said, you know, the death row inmates get all the attention. They get all the attention from the lawyers. They get all the attention from the organizations like the, what you're referring to, Michael, the Canadian Coalition Against the Death Penalty, maintaining websites for them and pen pals and all the rest of that. They get women who throw themselves at them and desperately try to marry them. And the guy's in for life. Nobody pays attention to them. Nobody cares about them. Mm-hmm. And the irony is that if you abolish the death penalty and convert those sentences to life without parole, you decrease the chances that innocent people are going to have their innocence revealed, because the efforts tend to come on behalf, the efforts to both make life more pleasant and to do justice in the sense of making sure that the innocents don't get punished, are focused heavily on the death penalty convicts, on those who are condemned to die. That's sort of the sexy group and the romantic group. So what do I think about the Canadian Coalition? I think it's perverse.
I do, too. I really do. And I also, then the second part of my question that I wanted to ask, these long, insidious delays in the execution, when we know for a fact that a person is responsible, there's no question, for example, in Polly Klass's case, that the man, you know, is responsible. There's no question. What is about these automatic appeals? I mean, it drives me insane. If they are convicted, hands down, the evidence shows there is no chance of a mistake. Why do we have to spend all the money and all the time on these individuals? Why can't they be marched from the courtroom into the death chamber and have death administered swiftly and judiciously? I just don't understand it.
Because for a couple of reasons. Because that's a solemn act that we do, and we want to make sure that we've got it right. It could be that this person factually is guilty, and yet there could be problems with the trial. There could have been serious errors made, procedural errors. There could have been incompetent counsel. And furthermore, so that every state guarantees an automatic appeal to the state Supreme Court. And then under federalism, the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment, the Fifth Amendment's prohibition or command of due process, reflected in the 14th Amendment, which applies to the states, requires that the federal government, some organ of the federal government, also get a chance to review it. So there's going to be an appeal to the state Supreme Court, as there should be. There should definitely be one appeal. Now, there's controversy as to whether after that you should be able to move for a writ of habeas corpus, you know, get out of jail free card. In this case, you're really not getting out of jail free, you're getting off the chamber, getting out of death row into general population, or getting a retrial or whatever, moving in the federal system. And in some circuits, it's delayed. I mean, ironically, the people who oppose the death penalty because of the unconscionable delays tend to be the very people who cause those delays. But it can be hastened. We cannot be a society that marches them out of the courtroom and executes them right away. There should be appellate review. There should be another set of collective eyes that takes a look at the trial and makes sure that there aren't egregious errors. Now, part of the problem is you've got abolitionist federal judges who will find and elevate error, minor error. There's always an error in every trial. There's never a perfect trial. There's never an error-free trial. But much of the error is harmless and trivial.
Mm-hmm.
And an abolitionist judge, federal judge, who's looking to find fault with it because he or she opposes the death penalty without qualification, will sometimes elevate into constitutional error that which is trivial error. Look,
right.
let me give you an example. It's before the United States. Maybe it's a perfect way to close it because it's a case that's coming up. It's called White v. Woodall. It was just argued before the United States Supreme Court on December 11th. And Woodall, Robert Woodall, took 16. He was sort of pissed off that his girlfriend was out partying or something and not with him. He had been recently released from prison for sexual molestation. He saw a 16-year-old Sarah Hansen at a convenience store in Kentucky. She mm-hmm. had gone out to rent a movie to show to her family. He raped her. He slit her throat with a box cutter. Huh. And he threw her still bleeding and alive into a lake to drown.
Oh, Jesus.
The evidence against him was overwhelming. Witnesses put him at the scene. His footprint was found near her body. His DNA showed up in her vaginal swabs. And her blood was on his clothes. I mean, it's just this open and shut case. So much so overwhelming was the evidence against him that he pled guilty. And then in the penalty phase of the trial, the defense asked, and he didn't testify in the penalty phase of the trial, and he didn't put on a claim of remorse, that he felt remorse. In fact, it would have been a very difficult claim to make because his grandmother his mother testified that right after he raped and murdered Sarah Hansen, who, by the way, was an honor student, an accomplished musician, and an athlete, not that that should make a difference to some degree, although it makes it worse than if he had killed a homeless, unconnected, drug-addicted vagrant
right.
himself was a
yeah.
criminal,
right.
although that's not politically correct to say, but it does make
no.
a difference.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, at the trial, the defense attorney asked for the judge to issue an instruction. And the instruction would be to the jury that they were not in any way to hold it against him that he had failed, that he had not testified. They asked for that instruction.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutor said, okay, I have no objection, you can give it. And the judge said, oh, no, I'm not giving that, because the fact that he didn't testify can show to a jury that he doesn't feel remorse.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't finish the statement. In fact, his mother testified that when he came home from the rape and murder of Sarah Hansen, he watched TV in a recliner and fell asleep. And the grandmother testified that he'd abused sexually his own her grandchildren, others that he was never prosecuted for. In any case, so the judge refused to give the instruction. The jury took an hour to come back with death.
Mm-hmm.
So he's sentenced to die. Now he appeals, and the Kentucky Supreme Court affirmed the death sentence, saying it's not a problem. But he appealed on the grounds that he should have been given, he was entitled to that instruction, that the failure to testify shall not be held against him. And so the question became, as it went through the federal system, and a district court issued a writ of habeas corpus, overturned the death penalty, and the Sixth Circuit affirmed the district court overturning the death penalty, and they said, look, the Supreme Court has held that you have the right to that kind of jury instruction at trial. They've also intimated that you shouldn't draw a distinction between trial and penalty phase, and therefore he had a right to that jury instruction. And we're reversing the conviction.
Oh, my God.
That was just argued before the United States Supreme Court. And in oral argument, some of the justices clearly said, as Michael would say, and probably you would say, Tricia, and that is, hey, even if this is error, and reasonable minds can disagree, it's harmless error.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a heinous case, just what you're saying. The evidence is so overwhelming, the deed is so vicious and foul, that even if he should have gotten that instruction, if we go ahead and execute him, it's harmless.
Right.
And other justices wouldn't sign on to that. And so it should be the long, this is a long answer, Michael, but as you know, the closing answer, maybe it's warranted.
Well,
it
we're going to have a few more questions,
faster.
But it should be
it,
done
it
faster.
It should be faster. It can be done faster, but you don't march him out from the courtroom and kill him. You've got to have an appellate set
I know. Of course, I always go to extremes. Someone raised a good question. You know, this business of remorse, I think, is really important. It would be to me as a juror, I know. And you were defending Jodi Arias, or not defending her by any means, but saying she didn't deserve death, by going to the length she went to hide the crime, hide the fact she was there, by showing no remorse. She was in bed with another man less than 24 hours later after the murder. And all during the trial, she bashed and trashed her victim. And even in her mitigation, when she was the only person to testify on her behalf, she again pounded home the lie that she was an abuse victim that the jury had obviously dismissed since they found her guilty, and in interviews that I've seen that they've done. Why, with showing no remorse and continuing to bash her victim, why don't you think that makes her... Well, the question that's posed in the chat room is, how does Scott Peterson get the death penalty and not Jodi, in your opinion? I embellish that with my whole story about the lack
of
remorse.
Yeah, that's a fair question, and you know, it's arguable. I don't know that I would have given... I mean, Scott Peterson is making phone calls, remember, when everyone's out searching for her?
Mm-hmm.
And he's watching all that, knowing that he's killed her, and putting the family through extended agony. There's none of that going on. There's none of that going on here. But the question of
pregnant.
Remorse. I'm sorry.
She was pregnant too. She was 9 months.
That's
pregnant.
That's correct. I'm glad you pointed that out. Yes, that does
right.
make it worse. The question of remorse is a perfectly good and very troubling question, by the way, especially for retributivists like me, for whom the past counts. Because on the one hand, remorse is something about the past. You're looking back at it, and again, in White v. Woodall, he never expressed remorse. By the way, expressing remorse and feeling remorse are two very separate things. I've had guys rehearse to me what their performance was going to be in front of the parole board. And it was so incredibly convincing. And these were guys who had just spent hours detailing all the crimes they were going to commit once they got out, as soon as they got out. And then they showed me what they were going to rehearse. Now, they were felt free to do that because the deal was, I'm not going to help you no matter what you do, and I'm not going to hurt you no matter what you do. That's the only way you can get it straight from them, which is, even if you're innocent and I'm convinced of it, I'm not going to lift a finger on your behalf. On the other mm-hmm. hand, I'm not going to lift a finger on your behalf to try to make it worse for you, even if I think you deserve it. That's the only way you get it to them, honestly. So, I mean, remorse and rehabilitation is rare, but it's real. It can't be forced, and it can easily be faked. But even when it's – and it can be real even when it's not expressed, and it can be false even when it is expressed. Mm-hmm. But there's a further tough distinction to be made, because this whole criminal justice thing ain't easy. I mean, I'm the first one to tell you that after all these years of doing this. There's a further distinction to be made, and it was Lee Mann, actually, who perceptively made it to me and opened my eyes to it. And what she said to me was, you know, guys come in their 20s, and they don't care mm-hmm. about anything. Anybody except themselves. And they get to their 30s and their 40s, and it starts taking a toll on them. And they come to really regret what they've done and put their own families through. And I explored it with her further, and I got her to articulate it, and I've since embraced it because I think it's right. There's a difference between regret and remorse. You can come, and it's fairly common. These guys have opened up to me. Most of them, by the time they get older, by the time we meet them, by the time I meet them in prison, although I met some wild, vicious young ones, but most mm-hmm. of the older guys I've met don't really resemble much the guys that they were in some ways when they killed and did what they did. And most of them express genuine regret. because of the life, their own life that they have come to believe has been wasted, come to realize has been largely wasted, because of what they do to their families who care about them and still visit and are very, or don't, and are very pained by what they imagine them to be going through. Life is really better for them than their families imagine it to be. But in any case, they come to regret what they're putting their families through. That's not remorse. That's regret.
Right.
That doesn't count for anything. That doesn't count for anything.
No.
I found genuine remorse to be really relatively rare, although the book goes through some poignant examples of it. One guy who just broke into tears and described to me the ritual as he approached every year the anniversary of the death of his victim, and how he fasts and lights a candle and mm-hmm. just thinks about him and why I was unnecessary, and hopes that he'll go to heaven so that he can meet his victim and say, I'm sorry. And I asked him, does he dream about him? And he said, yes, he still has recurrent nightmares. And I asked him about those nightmares, and it's always the victim saying to him, why me? Why me?
Oh.
And he said, I can't answer that. That's when he started crying. He said, I can't answer that. I want to answer him, and I can't answer him. Why you? Mm-hmm. He was just there. And I shot him, you know, to try to get his car, and he was there. This was a kid who didn't have a record before and deserved the long sentence that he got. I mean, and that was an example of genuine remorse, not just
right.
regret, but remorse. But it's rare.
Michael, go ahead. There's one more question you have, and then I have a final question for Professor Robert Blecker, author of the amazing book, The Death of Punishment. Go ahead, Michael.
Okay, I got to make sure I get everything in. First
okay.
of
go for it. You
First
can do
of all,
it.
There was so much in the book that we haven't even touched on. I thought one of the most interesting parts of the book had to do with crimes that are committed under the influence and whether or not that should alter how we feel or how we treat the ultimate crimes committed while under the influence. But we didn't get to it, so that's fine. My question to you is this, and it goes back to Tricia's question of what can we do. Is there any way to start something like a coalition for a change to our criminal justice system where there could be a united effort where like-minded individuals can join and petitions and get just a rallying cry behind these ideas you've set forth in The Death of Punishment, and how could we go about doing such a thing?
I guess there is, Michael, and I know it's frustrating because you've given me my opening and you've done it twice now, and I don't seem to take it, and I recognize
no.
that. I just know my own. I know my own deficits. I am not an organizer. I am not. I'm never a committee chairperson at the school because I am not an administrator. I don't do well. Yes, I mean in my imagination and dream and hope, a number of people would read this book. They would say, sure, collective wisdom can further modify it, but this provides us the essence of the program. Maybe they start in local chapters of Let the Punishment Fit the Crime or something like that, and they would use this as a starting point. People would read it, they would discuss it, they would urge their local groups, their local church groups or temple groups or educational groups or whatever groups they belong to that discuss current events to use the book as a reading book that it would be assigned in, at least it's the other side of, in death penalty courses. I mean, so that, but I know myself. I'm not an organizer.
Well, and don't you know anyone? I don't, or I would be starting the coalition myself, but I'm like you. I'm a quick joiner, but I don't tend to know how to take the lead on something like this. But
and by the way, that's
important.
That's I know, and that's the unfortunate irony. When you see the organizations who are feeding the media with their press releases, and there are so many people in the United States who are earning their living exclusively in opposing the death penalty, and there's nobody who's earning his living in supporting it. Nobody. And they're very well organized, which is why they seem to create the appearance of a public outcry against it when it doesn't exist. They go to all the hearings. They testify as the expert witnesses. In conferences, I'm so often the only person And when I've testified in front of legislatures, I'm often one of very few. If they have 50 witnesses, three of us will be against the death. Will be against abolishing the death penalty, and the other 47 will be supporting the proposed new legislation. As if that reflects the split in American society when it doesn't. You know, the Richard Nixon, unfortunately.
Call me to testify. Call me to testify with you. Call me to testify with you.
Sure. Sure.
I just
sure.
Really,
I mean,
I don't know.
And then so I guess that's more of the message, Michael, which is when if this has a national reach, and if your own particular state is holding hearings in whether to abolish the death penalty or to retain it, go to those hearings, testify, let write to your representatives. And again, you if chapters formed, if people read the book and said, you know something, he's right. I've always known he's right, but he articulates it and then forces it on their liberal brother-in-law and says, hey, read this.
I can't stress that enough, but it's not a reach for me. I want justice. I want justice
right.
for victims and families. So
we all
that
want
is
it.
Not
and
a
we,
liberal conservative issue, I don't
it's,
think.
You're right. You're absolutely right. It's not. It's not, and it shouldn't be.
Uh-uh.
We all want justice. You're exactly
it's
right.
It's a humanity thing, yeah.
Yes.
Well, here's what I think, gentlemen. I do believe that what needs to happen is the mainstream media needs to pick up on this, because the one thing that will push the death of punishment and the idea that Professor Blecker has for it, it will be pushed only by the public's outrage at what is happening in these cases. I'm not exactly sure how to go about it. I do know, Professor Blecker, that by you coming on this show and continuing to talk and to push, that's a beginning. And maybe if we can put our heads together, we can come up with something. I just don't know. I'm like with Michael. I don't know what to do. If somebody could organize it, I could help. But I don't even know where to begin to organize this. Professor Blecker, I'm going to give you the final word, and you can take as long as you'd like to wrap things up for us.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you and thank Michael for this opportunity. This is the most sustained conversation, public conversation I've ever had on this,
good.
And I appreciate the opportunity to do it. Again, I'd like people to buy the book, but much more important is that people read the book and think about it. And if we are all committed to the basic principle of justice, let the punishment fit the crime, then we have an obligation to know whether the punishment does fit the crime. And when we determine that the punishment doesn't fit the crime, we have an obligation to do our best to make it more nearly fit the crime. And it seems to me if we don't avoid it and we take it upon ourselves to care about it, to put ourselves in the shoes of the victim, and then also remember the other side of it, to put ourselves in the shoes of those who are being overpunished, and oppose that. If we really reconnect crime with punishment, I don't see how we can just sit here and be satisfied with what's happening. Then hopefully those who are better organized than I and whom organizing is in their blood will take it upon themselves to help us all be more committed to justice. And if we are more committed to justice, then I expect that something along the lines, not this very program, but at least let it be a start. Take it seriously. Take our commitment seriously. We made that commitment in the Constitution. We claim to care about justice. Let's put our money where our mouth is. Let's put our effort where our mouth is. Let's not be satisfied with the mockery that the criminal justice system is today.
Amen.
Amen, and that is a perfect note to wrap this up. Professor Blecker, thank you so much. The book is called The Death of Punishment. You can go to websleuth.com. It's on the right-hand side of the page on our rolling Amazon ad. It's available, I believe, in hardcover and in Kindle version. I had the Kindle version. It's fantastic. And Professor Blecker, if you ever want to come back to the show, you have an open invitation to any time that you would like to join us, okay?
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
There's so much we missed. There's so much we missed. The book
you got to read the book. We
yeah.
literally could go on all night. That's absolutely true. Hey, today's show is sponsored by the wonderful people at Purple Hearts, actually Pause for Purple Hearts, in Palo Alto, California. Pause for Purple Hearts is the first program of its kind to offer therapeutic intervention for veterans and active duty military personnel by teaching those with post-traumatic stress disorder to train service dogs for their comrades with combat-related injuries. Go to pauseforpurplehearts.org. Do remember, opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests, and Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. And Professor Bleckner, thank you again for joining us. Michael, as always, you're a doll, and thanks to Sleuth 5 in the chat room for keeping things under control. We'll be back next week with another edition of Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss current events and true crime, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody.
Thanks, Trisha.